You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to Glad Tidings, the Athletics Everton Football Club podcast. It's Thursday afternoon and joining you as ever is me, Greg O'Keefe, and my colleague, fellow Everton correspondent Paddy Boyland. We'll try and keep the kitchen appliance and wildlife noises down to a minimum this week, because indeed we're celebrating a good bit of news this afternoon. Well, certainly Dominic Calvert-Lewin will be celebrating a good bit of news with his England call-up. Before we go into that, we're offering you the opportunity to subscribe to Athletic for just £1 a month. You can access all of our writing on the Blues, including Paddy's recent piece on last night's hat-trick hero, which explains why Calvert-Lewin is just so good at heading a football. The offer is only running for a limited time, so get yourself to theathletic.com/EvertonPod to sign up. That's theathletic.com/EvertonPod, and you'll pay just £1 for a month. Right, Pad. I wasn't being reductive about your piece. It was. Why is he so good at heading a football, isn't it? Tell us why.
Yeah, it's important that you clarify that. But I did know. I think it's more clarifying that for the listeners. I did know that you weren't being reductive about my piece. That is basically what it's about. Although, kind of as we go through, I speak to somebody about his heading ability. And I described it in the piece as elite. What I mean by that is, I think if you're elite, you're the best among your peers or among the best. And in a Premier League context, since the start of last season, 2019-20, no player has scored more headed goals than Dominic Calvert-Lewin in the league. So I think that says an awful lot about his ability in the air. But he ranks really high for kind of things like aerial duels won, all that kind of stuff. And I spoke to a biomechanics expert who'd worked and assessed Cristiano Ronaldo for a Sky documentary before. And he kind of his own accord, really discussed Dominic in relation to Cristiano Ronaldo. And I think Cristiano Ronaldo's really stand out as well. In terms of his heading ability. But there are comparisons to be made between the two. I'm not saying that they're exactly the same player.
Steady.
Big kind of disclaimer there before anyone gets too far ahead of themselves. But what I am saying is that he's kind of in stature and in the way he approaches the ball. The expert I spoke to did see similarities. So I spoke to him. I spoke to Bob Latchford, Everton legend Bob Latchford, who I didn't see. I was too young to see in an Everton shirt. I've only seen YouTube montages of his goals and heard my dad and my granddad wax lyrical about his heading ability over the years. I'm reliably informed he was great in the air as well. Spoke to Bob about Dominic's ability and what he made of it, and he spoke about kind of what you need to do on the training ground to become a top striker, a top header of the ball, and just loads of different people just getting a sense of how this guy in Calvert-Lewin went from not really scoring that many goals, truth be told, to being this penalty box poacher. And time it comes back again to the same old things, doesn't it? It comes back to all those sessions with Duncan Ferguson in training and after training at Finch Farm, where they worked on finishing together. Those two with a really close bond, as we've mentioned before. Ancelotti's bit of stardust on top, coming in and looking at kind of video footage with Dominic and how he can refine his game, refine his movement, become more of a penalty box striker. emulating people. Like, I think he mentioned Pippo Inzaghi, didn't he, after the game against, was it West Brom? After the game against West Brom, the hat-trick against West Brom, Pippo Inzaghi was mentioned purely because of his one-touch finishing. And yeah, I guess we're starting to see some of that, again, disclaimer, some of that from Dominic in the way he's scoring goals. I don't always think they're the most aesthetically beautiful to watch. In most cases, they tend to be finishes into the corner, rebounds, headers at the back post, all the kind of stuff that you come to expect from a number nine. Maybe not the standout goals of a Richarlison or James Rodriguez, but he is turning into a very good striker and a really potent striker. And we spoke to him after the game against West Ham in the Carabao Cup on Wednesday night. We spoke to Ancelotti about him, I should say. And Ancelotti never wants to get too effusive normally, in my
opinion.
No,
he doesn't, does he?
He doesn't. Yeah. He's kind of quite understated, and he likes to keep people in check and manage expectations and all those kinds of things. I was really surprised when he described Calvert-Lewin as being on fire. Carlo way more effusive than he normally is. But I think that's about right. I think sometimes we get too wrapped up in the cynicism and looking to be cautious with Everton because we've been burned so many times before by false dawns. But here, even Carlo's getting a little bit under stress, a little bit giddy over Calvert-Lewin's form. What is that now? 8 goals in 5 games, 2 hat-tricks. And as I think I wrote on Twitter, as I think you'll have written on Twitter, the England call-up's fully merited. I don't care personally about England call-ups. I'd rather actually had his feet up and he was resting ahead of the Merseyside derby. That would be my preference. But it means a lot to Calvert-Lewin himself. I think it adds the kind of the prestige of being an Everton player and all those kinds of things. If players come to the club knowing that they can make that step. So there's some good here as well, and he richly deserves that call-up. It really, really is merited, in my opinion.
No, I completely agree. It's very much merited. You've seen England call up so many players in recent years when they've been experimenting with different systems and different ways of playing under Southgate for a lot less than his unbelievable start to the season. And, you know, the movement and the way he's playing, I can see him replicating it on the international stage as well. And again, you know, there's the other flip side to it, which is, you know, Evertonians do tend to be, or can be, I suppose at best, ambivalent about England. And, you know, I think you have to go back to like sort of Nick Barmby and seeing our star men get called up. And then in Barmby's case, promptly trying to find a way out of the club when his head got turned, perhaps. But you remember Bill Kenwright famously wrote to the England manager at the time, didn't he, to try and implore him to select Barmby. But nevertheless, it'd be churlish to be too down on this because Dominic's spoken about it being a dream of his. And, you know, for a lad who cost what he cost, came through at Sheffield United. And like you said, he was almost the striker that didn't score goals. That was a tag that followed him in the early part of his Everton career, wasn't it? And I have to be honest, I didn't ever predict this upsurge in form. He just seems so clinical now. He's a proper poacher. And I can see him, doing it on the international stage. And as long as he doesn't get injured, then I'm really, really pleased for him. His goals, His goals, of course, were a major talking point from the game against West Ham. A few less so positive, really. Literally a few in terms of 3 injuries. Not great for Jonjo Kenny. And I don't mean to undermine that, but of course he's been or is an understudy for Seamus Coleman, so while we hope and wish him well because we need him as backup, it's probably more concerning the injuries to Alan and Richarlison, 2 hugely influential players in the positive start to our season and just talismanic in different ways. How do you think that might affect us if they're not available against Brighton?
Just very, very quickly, and you've not asked me about this, so apologies. But just to go back to Jonjo, I did feel really sorry for him because he's come back from Schalke and he wants to make it work at Everton.
Yeah,
but he's found himself behind Seamus Coleman. I think Seamus had a really good, perhaps slightly underrated, start of the campaign in some quarters. He's not taken up column inches, but I actually think he's had a little bit of a kind of a mini renaissance in the opening 5-6 games of the campaign. I guess 3 in his case in the Premier League. So Jonjo's found himself, he's come back and he's found himself, despite having a good time at Schalke, he's found himself behind Seamus. So the Carabao Cup is an opportunity to impress, to really impress. And that was kind of cruelly taken away from him. And I know people get kind of pent up on, particularly on social media, as everyone tends to on social media anyway, but about Everton's injuries. And they've got another injury again, and we're cursed, and we don't get any luck. Or if kind of conversely, people pointing the finger of blame at medical staff. You look at some of the injuries on Wednesday night against West Ham, and I would just describe them as unfortunate. Quite often, I mean, Jonjo goes to block a cross, doesn't he? And is you can see his ankle almost on impact, twisting the ground. One that I kind of winced at when I saw that from the main stand press box. Richarlison did his kind of racing back, trying to tackle it, I think, if memory serves. And the same again with Alan. You are right, though, that Alan and the Richarlison injury, they're the two that are going to get fans slightly worried ahead of the game against Brighton on Saturday. Carlo was pretty positive after the game, particularly in relation to Richarlison, although he said that while he didn't believe the injuries were too bad, in his words, they did need to have checks to determine the full extent of the injuries on Thursday. So today, the day we're recording, we're still waiting on those results. But if the indications about Richarlison are true and he could still be in contention for Brighton, that would be a big deal, obviously. Richarlison playing in that position on the left, I think, is almost irreplaceable. And I don't want to say that too lightly, but I think he is almost irreplaceable in this system, given the unique range of elements that he brings to the table. He's great off the ball, as we know, and I know you in particular, you focused on that before in pieces, his ball recoveries and his tackles for a player in the front three. Those stats are really quite impressive. But just that ability to pick up the ball and drive, and that never say die attitude, and the finishing, the ability to link with Dominic Calvert-Lewin. You can get some of this from various other players in the squad. So Iwobi might be slightly more creative, for example, coming off the left than Richarlison. And Anthony Gordon might offer the same direct running. But to wrap it all up into one player, it shows you what a unique player Everton have in Richarlison. So fingers crossed that, as Ancelotti said on Wednesday night, that injury isn't too severe. It doesn't sound like it is in any case. Alan as well, I think to outline his importance, I'll go back to a tweet I sent during the game, and James loses the ball against West Ham. I think it's in the first half. He loses the ball midway in West Ham's half to Felipe Anderson, I think it is. And the ball kind of squirts loose. Anderson goes haring after it down the left flank, and you think that West Ham are going to be away. They're going to be on the counter-attack with Anderson, one of their most dangerous players, running into space. And just out of nowhere, Alan, from his position in the centre, races across himself, slides in to tackle Anderson and put the ball out of play. And I tweeted at the time during the game, live during the game, that it's the kind of run and interception we've not really seen to any great extent since Idrissa Gueye left the club. And I think that's the best way of describing maybe his importance to this current Everton side. He's the guy that screens with Doucouré at times. Doucouré helps, digs in when Everton, like against Palace, are slightly under the cosh for periods. But Alan is your main guy in there, and I think he's had a really good start to his time at Goodison anyway. So it doesn't sound like his injury is quite maybe as soft, if we want to call it that, as some of the other ones, particularly Richarlison's. You just have to hope those two guys are close to irreplaceable, in my opinion, in the current squad. The only thing I would say is that I was pretty pleased with the other midfield performances on Wednesday against West Ham. It was Premier League opposition. They had people like Mark Noble in there, for what that's worth. And I thought Fabian Delph and Gylfi Sigurdsson were really quite good again after turning up against Fleetwood, and in Sigurdsson's case, Salford as well. What did you make of, I mean, you saw the game as well. What did you make of Delph? To me, he looks like the one, if Alan is out against Brighton, provided he's still fit, Delph, and able to put in another 60, 70 minutes, he'd be the one I would plump for in there to just give that midfield a bit of solidity.
I think so, yeah. I agree with you. I think I was pleasantly surprised how he played against Fleetwood, and more so last night. Kind of seeing the Delph that many people didn't think we would see at all in a blue shirt, you know, and understandably so after his last game before Fleetwood being February. If he can stay fit was the key part of what you were just saying then. But I'd think that starting him in lieu of Alan would make sense. And then you've got options then if he tires, you know, after 60, 70 minutes, you can look at Tom Davies to come on. But yeah, he seems not a like-for-like by any means replacement, but he certainly seems to be showing what he can do a bit more. And he's got that solidity as well. He's going to sit. And I thought Doucouré did well when he came on last night, and thankfully he's fit. So it isn't the end of the world. And we do have the good fortune of, after the Brighton game, the international break for Alan and Richarlison to get fully fit. So not the end of the world, I suppose. Of course, we are chasing, remarkably, aren't we, a fifth straight win in the league. After Palace, we got over the line against Palace. Blues understandably getting giddy. Maybe not so much some neutrals, particularly Roy Keane. Let's just listen to what he had to say about that.
We talk about Everton. They've beaten Spurs. Lots of teams have beat Spurs. They beat West Brom, who were down to 10 men. They were fortunate with the handball. So let's not get too giddy about Everton either.
Have you ever got giddy about anything?
Well, I have to say, I'm all for Jamie Carragher's reaction there. Maybe I'll not go down the same road as when we were chatting before we started recording. But I would say he doesn't get giddy about anything, does he? He does like to play the arch sort of grump. And, it's a contrary view. You could say, yes, you know, we have had the luck of the draw, certainly against Palace. I don't think you can talk about anything but a fantastic performance at Tottenham. And again, you know, yeah, we conceded a couple of soft goals against West Brom, but then we blew them away. So a little bit surly, that one. What do you make of our chances of, well, I suppose the Palace game, and then our chances of going in and doing the business again against Brighton?
It was funny, actually, because you were covering the Palace game, weren't you, for the site and for the app. And I actually had, I've been trying to wriggle out of a flat viewing. I'm moving flat next month. So I'd been trying to wriggle out of a flat viewing. So I ended up kind of going around this flat with Amazon Prime on my phone, watching the game. So watching the game, and obviously things are happening, and I'm kind of trying to keep myself in check and look at the flat as well to see if it's what I'm after. I get down after seeing the flat, get down to the main lobby and ask the guy on reception. So I didn't see a washing machine there. Is there a kind of a communal laundry room? And he just looks at me for a couple of minutes as if I'm some kind of bizarre specimen come from outer space. And says, yeah, there's one immediately when you go in on your left. And in the apartment, every apartment has one. And I'll be honest, I probably took in about 50% of the apartment, much more concentrated and focused on what was happening with Everton. I don't actually think, and I did rewatch the whole game later on, and it kind of tallied with my immediate impression. I don't actually think Everton played that well on the ball. In terms of possession and keeping the ball, Palace, particularly MacArthur and McCarthy, were kind of right up and at the midfield whenever they took possession off the defence and made it very difficult to turn around and supply the strikers. But they did create Everton enough moments. And the reason they created enough moments, in my opinion, is because they have this superlative talent in James Rodriguez. And I tweeted a half time in that game that the Everton goals just don't happen. without somebody of his quality, he's not going to get an assist. He certainly didn't score the goals in that case. But the kind of the round the corner pass to Seamus Coleman for the first goal was absolutely wonderful on his weaker foot, of course. And then the ball, the crossfield ball that we've seen so often to Luka Dean in the opening Premier League games, creates the space from which Everton win the penalty. It's almost pass before the pass stuff. I think some stats kind of nerds term it pre-assists.
That's
pre-assists, the pass before the pass. And James does that very well as well. So Everton have that extra guile on the ball, that even if they're not necessarily consistently playing the right pass, you expect them 3, 4, 5 times a game at least with James to break through and to carve out good, clear-cut chances. And Calvert-Lewin's benefiting from that, as we said earlier. He's getting on the end of stuff. Richarlison is as well. But I think we're seeing Luka Dean and Seamus Coleman being really effective in attack, partly because of James's influence, partly because of Gomez's influence, and just the kind of the extra confidence in the side as well. And again, we saw the benefits of having Alan and Doucouré doing what it seems unfair to call it this, but the dirty work in midfield, making those interceptions, breaking up play, tactical fouls at times, which every team needs to do, let's be honest. It struck me, and I don't know if it was the same with you, but if Everton had played this Palace side, who I think have improved last season with last season's Everton players, I don't even think they'd have drawn that game. I think they would have lost. I think they lost 1-0 to a set piece because they wouldn't have looked like scoring. Kouyaté is about 8'10" and was towering over the defence and obviously scored one, nearly scored another. I think Everton would have conceded that goal still under Marco Silva, and I don't think they would have had the guile or the ingenuity without James and without Calvert-Lewin being in such hot form to turn that round. So when you win your home games and you turn tough assignments at Palace from defeats and draws into wins, that's a big statement of intent for me, even if it's early doors. That's the kind of result that Manchester City get. It's the kind of result, dare I say it, that Liverpool get. In fact, it's probably not even the result Manchester City get, because Manchester City aren't looking great at the moment themselves, are they? But you get the drift. I think it's kind of a Champions League qualifying result in isolation. And I'm pained to do that because we need to look at things over 38 games. But it does show Everton are on the right trajectory. And I do think actually it's right for Everton fans to get a little bit giddy. We all need that extra enjoyment in our lives, and we absolutely deserve it after some of the dirge that was served up in the second half of the campaign, particularly after lockdown.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Deadline day approaching Monday, 11 p.m. We've done a piece on the app now, on the site now, if you want to go and check it out, about which central defenders may or may not be on their way to Goodison Park. Still absolute priority for Carlo Ancelotti and Marcel Brands is to bring in another defender. You know, you've seen Lucas Dean having to play there in the Carabao Cup. They are thin on the ground. God forbid an injury to either sort of Michael Keane or Yerry Mina. So that's on the cards. Don't think we expect any other business. You can never say never beyond that. But just quickly, Pad, for people who've not yet read the article, we're still sort of thinking alone, but of course there is the development of this strong interest in Ben Godfrey that might mean a permanent deal, mightn't it?
Yeah, so Ben Godfrey obviously is somebody that was mentioned earlier this week in our columns in relation to Everton. He's been a player that Everton have liked for quite a while, actually, although certainly earlier this summer was not considered to be a top target. That obviously was Gabriel, who went from Lille to Arsenal eventually. Godfrey is somebody that Everton have liked, and there's still a shortlist. There's a shortlist, a good number of players on that shortlist, we believe, including, I mean, who did we have? We had Tomori, Zuma, Ongwene, Jerome Ongwene, who I mentioned from Salzburg on last week's pod. We've written a little bit about him as well. Tadebo, Jean-Claire Tadebo, the Barcelona defender. All these guys in the melting pot with others, it must be said, for that centre-half berth. Everton wouldn't have gone back into the market. All indications were that they would not have gone back into the market without the injury to Mason Holgate in particular, but then also the one to Jared Branthwaite. But those injuries mean that they are looking at an option. And originally, as Ancelotti himself had outlined, they were looking at a loan signing. With some of those guys, particularly Tomori, who obviously they tried for, they did prefer the loan route. And I think if somebody offered them Tomori right now on loan, or Kurt Zuma right now on loan — Zuma would not happen, by the way — but if somebody offered them Tomori right now on loan, I think Everton would bite Chelsea's hands off. The fact of the matter is, though, that certainly that's become more difficult than it looked at first. And some of the other options are a bit kind of hit and miss in some ways with regards to how achievable they would be. So we're in this situation now where I think it's slightly fluid. Everton would like a loan, but they're not completely discounting the idea of spending money on Ben Godfrey. And I think, as we wrote in the article, Everton do like the player. The player would like to come to Everton. Norwich are unlikely to accept 20-ish million, which is the figure that's being bandied around when the clubs have spoken to each other. And that leads us to this kind of fluid situation in which Everton like Godfrey, but they also like Tomori, and they also like Zuma and various other players. It makes it, let's say, less than optimal for reporting when so many pieces of the jigsaw are still in place. But I think that's just the point we stressed in the article, wasn't it? That, of course, Godfrey is a target. He's on the shortlist. But Everton themselves would readily admit, I think, that they're still pursuing a number of what you would consider to be active targets. So it's one to watch. It's no secret now that Everton like Godfrey, and it's no secret that Everton wants a centre-back. When Carlo was asked about this on Wednesday night, he did his usual, which is say that he wouldn't comment on the speculation about Godfrey, but he did, and he doesn't always do this, say that Godfrey was, I think, very good player, if I remember the quote I took down correctly. So yeah, Godfrey is somebody that's been discussed. Would I be surprised if he ends up at Goodison? No. Would I be surprised if he doesn't end up at Goodison? Not particularly. It will all depend what's offered between now and the window closing on the 5th of October.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We needn't count our chickens in terms of Everton's men's side getting to Wembley just yet, although fantastic to be in the quarter-final of the League Cup. But Everton ladies are very much on the way to Wembley, aren't they? Fantastic result for them in midweek after another great result previously. They're flying at the moment, start of the season, going great guns under Willie Kirk, and now imminently a Wembley appearance. Special things are happening for both teams this season, but the ladies have really sort of set the standard, haven't they?
Yeah, I think that's entirely right. And getting to the Women's FA Cup final is a big achievement in the current context, because I don't think that coming into the season they were seen by wider national media as being the ones that were going to usurp some of these sides like Chelsea and whoever else. Everton obviously beat Chelsea in the quarterfinal at Goodison on Sunday, which I was at, and I was bowled over not only by some of the moves for the goals, but also the determination and how well coordinated manager Willie Kirk has them It's quality, there's grit. It's a typical Everton team in many ways, to be honest. And that was summed up, as I wrote in the piece, by Australian signing in January, Hayley Raso, who I described as a Duracell bunny when describing her, purely because she just keeps on going and going and going. And when she's knocked down, she gets back up and then she gives it back in spades. She'll either go barging into somebody or she'll create a goal, as she did against Chelsea. And that was seen as a shock result. But I think there was real belief in the Everton ranks from Kirk, the manager, and the players that they could beat Chelsea. They backed it up on Wednesday night, the same night as the Carabao Cup game, between Everton's men's side and West Ham. They backed that up by beating Birmingham 3-0 at Birmingham in the semi-final to get into the final. And it's a massive achievement. They thoroughly deserve to be there. Delighted to see the progress they've made. And like you say, it continues that feel-good factor of Everton's men being 6 from 6, Everton's women now 100% in the league into the final of the Women's FA Cup. The under-18s going real good guns in the under-18s Premier League, beating everyone in the sight apart from Manchester City, and even that was a draw. And the under-23s, they thumped Derby County on Monday night with Ellis Sims scoring a couple of goals again. So I don't know what's going on, to be honest with you, mate. I can't remember the last time this many sides that represent Everton did this well at the start of a campaign. And even if you just take the men's team in isolation, I don't know if you saw that stat from Opta. The first six wins, 6 from 6, means that's the first time Everton have done that particular thing since 1938-39 season.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
It's absolutely remarkable. And then if they were to beat Brighton, I think that would be 1894, the last time they did 7 from 7 at the start of a season. So that puts into context, I think, how impressive, just on the men's side, the form has been. Then you add in the women's success, which is absolutely fantastic. Under-18s going well. Under-23s beating some good sides and scoring goals. Across the club, there's an awful lot to be positive about. It's a joy as a journalist to be able to to write about that stuff, isn't it? You always want those positive, good news stories, and thankfully at this moment in time, we're getting them.
We certainly are. And on a bit of a tangent, but nevertheless a positive news story for Blues, certainly one that put a smile on most supporters' faces, was being not just top of the league briefly, but top of the charts, the iTunes music charts, top 10 in the UK, with Spirit of the Blues. Anyone who's been to Goodison on the match, they'll be, or in fact been on Twitter in the past 72 hours, be familiar with that song. It's an oldie from 1984. But it's for me, it's really reminiscent of those Goodison match days that we all miss daily at the moment. It's been number one after Blues got it, a bit of a viral campaign really after the Palace game to get it there. People started sharing videos of various celebrities dubbed up to dancing along to it, and it started trending, didn't it? It all went a bit nuts. Yeah. Next minute, Everton were 1, 2, and 3 in the iTunes charts with that, Z Cars and Forever Everton. And not content with that, they even managed to get Howard's Way, the film released last year, which you wrote a great piece about, to the top of the iTunes movie downloads as well. So it was,
Did you have a favourite, by the way, of the videos?
Yeah, it's the little guy. For me, it's the little guy in the glasses in the nightclub, and that's some Eastern European country just dancing away. Yeah. Like that was my favourite. My brother liked the Shawshank Redemption one. What about you?
The Shawshank Redemption one was absolutely fantastic. I love that, because we'd had all, I think that came out slightly later than the others, hadn't it? And the initial ones were all dancing. And this one for Shawshank was just perfectly timed for the scene where music comes on in Shawshank around the prison and they're all looking up to see what's going on, and they all stop, and it looks like they're just listening and taking in this Spirit of the Blues song. So I like that one. I thought the John Travolta Uma Thurman dance from Pulp Fiction was good, but that's just because I'm a bit of a Tarantino Pulp Fiction nerd, so I enjoyed enjoyed that. But they've all been brilliant, and it's great to see the success. It's also good to see fans being so positive and so unified on social media, which I think can be a difficult place at times, particularly after defeats. Just to see what can be achieved when fans pull together, when Everton fans are united. There's an awful lot of them, as you can see from the numbers in the charts, and some very funny messages to Miley Cyrus and various other people, Jason Derulo in the charts off the back of that. So, I think it's good to see that kind of stuff in a week, isn't it? Not just purely football-related stuff, but stuff off the pitch as well. It all does add to that feel-good factor, as we mentioned earlier.
It certainly does, and let's hope we keep it going. We'll obviously be back after the window closes next week to discuss who did and didn't arrive, as Everton look to really keep that feel-good feeling that Paddy mentions there flowing with yet another win. Thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.